The bailout package was actually opposed by some 100 economists who signed a letter lobbying Congress not to back it. And among them was Harvard economist Jeffrey Miron, who spoke with us before, and he joins us again this morning. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning.
So you opposed the bill. The market slumped down $1.2 trillion, which sounds like an enormous amount of money. Is this working for you?
It's too early to tell. Certainly, nobody's happy about the decline in the market, but I was very happy that the bailout didn't go through. What we don't know is what Congress or the Treasury or the Federal Reserve will do next. And I think part of the market's reaction is simply there's now increased uncertainty or continued uncertainty about what will happen, and that's terrible for the markets. They need to know exactly what the rules are. And some rules and some outcomes are better than others for the Wall Street and for other people, but the crucial thing is to have policy pick a lane and stay in the lane. And so until we know exactly what the Congress is going to do, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty and a lot of unhappiness. The crucial thing is there are a lot of assets which are worth a lot less than the values that are shown on the books right now. Until that is fully recognized, okay, it's going to be hard for credit markets to start functioning well again, because nobody knows exactly to whom they should be willing to make loans because they don't know what those institutions are worth.
But wasn't that part of the plan, though, is to try to figure out exactly what those assets are worth? And one way to do that is to buy time by having the federal government swoop in, get a hold of them, and then set up a process to value those assets.
It was, okay, and that part of it made some sense. But there's another procedure, which is allowing individual institutions to go bankrupt, which accomplishes basically the same thing. It means that the books are opened up and the creditors own those institutions, and people can figure out exactly what's worth something and what's no longer worth very much. And by leaving it to that process as opposed to having the bailout occur, the distributional effects are very different. Instead of the taxpayers paying for it, the shareholders of those institutions and the creditors of those institutions pay for it. And the bankruptcy process is actually quite swift in many ways. A firm can declare bankruptcy in a matter of hours, then certain things are frozen, and people know that that institution is going to continue, but under different ownership. The bailout was going to generate lots of delays, lots of process, and be a very, very inefficient way of trying to accomplish what bankruptcy could do.
Well, tell me this, Jeffrey, for lay people like myself, at the rate the markets are going, it looks like taxpayers are going to end up paying one way or the other. What do you think should be done now?
I basically think that nothing should be done now, although I clearly don't expect that that's what will happen. I'm sure that policymakers will do something, because that's sort of the way policymakers think. Yes, someone was going to pay one way or the other, and of course, since taxpayers own the stock market and overall, to some degree, taxpayers have to pay one way or another, because all these bad loans were made, and someone has to pay for that. But with the bailout, much, much more of the cost was going to be shifted on the general taxpayer, and much, much less on the people who took these risks in the asset markets. And that's one of the crucial differences between a bankruptcy approach and a bailout approach.
Well, Jeffrey, last week you suggested that perhaps the capital requirements, something that we talked about here just a moment ago, should be relaxed for banks. And coupled with the bankruptcy that you talked about, how quickly do you think we'd get to a point where banks would start lending again? What would be happening? What sort of bottom would we hit for the credit markets to loosen up again? And I presume that's something that you want.
Of course, it's something that we all want. I think that if the government could actually tie its hands, could act as though it was going to let the process just work its way through, and unfortunately, that's a very hard thing for it to do. But if it could, we're talking about a few months in which a bunch of bankruptcies would be declared, there would be a lot of reshuffling, a lot of people would be a lot poorer at the end of that, but markets would begin functioning quite well in a relatively short period of time.
Is that Milton Friedman medicine for the U.S. of A.?
Yeah, in essence, that's a very fair characterization.
Really? Well, it was pretty destabilizing for Latin America. You're not expecting people to get in the streets with pitchforks, are you, quickly?
I actually think that's not a right characterization of what happened in Latin America. So that's kind of takes us too far afield. But my view is that what happened in the U.S. was a huge amount of government intervention created a problem that we're now paying for. Policy encouraged a ton of risky lending, and now somebody has to pay for that.
Got it. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Jeffrey Miron, thanks so much for joining us again. We do appreciate it.
It's a great view.
Jeffrey Miron is an economist at Harvard University.
Hey, There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.